The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly, and welcome to the BFI South Bank here in London. I'm Jason Solomons, and yes, for Film Weekly this week, we bring you a very special edition as we celebrate the work of the late and truly great British director, Sir David Lean. Lean directed 16 feature films in his career, and to celebrate the restoration of his first 10 films and a UK-wide tour of these classics, the elite of British cinema have gathered here tonight at the BFI South Bank to discuss and debate the extraordinary contribution to cinema made by David Lean. I'll be introducing on-stage luminaries of the British film scene who've all been influenced by David Lean. Actors including Prunella Scales and Sarah Miles, as well as James Fox and Nigel Havers. There'll also be Sir Alan Parker and, from the modern era, Joe Wright and Seamus McGarvey, as we attempt this evening to sum up such an exceptional catalogue of films all made by one man. David Lean was a filmmaker of epics. Films such as Dr. Zhivago, The Bridge Over the River Kwai, and Lawrence of Arabia literally extended the canvas on which cinema rested. Highly visual, Lean's films almost created the need for the term cinematic, and yet his work is also striking in its ability to tell stories of intimacy. The early films, which have now been beautifully restored, include the intimate details of the everyday, films such as This Happy Breed, Brief Encounter, and The Passionate Friends. But on films such as Ryan's Daughter and Dr. Zhivago, Lean had the gift to change from the macro to the micro and explore the intricate architecture of his characters and their stories. The scope of his work was due in part to the scope of his film career, starting as a clapperboard boy in the 1920s, and then working as an editor, and finally a director. And by the late 1940s, he was the leading filmmaker of his generation. With such an expansive cinematic endeavour, there is without doubt much to discuss and debate by our panel and the audience, arriving as we speak here at BFI South Bank. And for now, we turn to Cinema One here at the NFT, and to our celebration of the work and the legacy of Sir David Lean.
A restorer to a man who is very proud to say he's been influenced by David Lean, a former chair of the BFI, Sir Alan Parker, ladies and gentlemen. Presumably, you grew up on his cinema.
I did. I mean, I think particularly the Dickens films, which are the ones which I think are the most influential on me, with regards to as a director, I probably did see there was in their 18th version, at the Fleet Pit in Islington, very scratchy, but I do remember those images more than. And then when I was a teenager and you start to get interested in film, maybe then seeing Lawrence, you're a different kind of person and therefore you're looking for different things. But I think as a kid, it was probably It was Great Expectations and Oliver Twist, which were the most influential to me.
Well, you've chosen for us tonight, I think, one of the most famous bits of British cinema that there is. You've chosen sort of the opening sequence from Great Expectations. Why have you chosen this before we let everyone enjoy it?
The first screenplay I wrote, 35 years ago, which was David Putnam's first film, about 20 minutes in, the little girl in the story, she buys a goldfish. Then from then on, the film's pretty well okay, but up to that point, it was quite dire, actually. So I always used to say, in a film, you should really try and get to the goldfish as soon as possible, preferably on the first page of the script. And if ever there is a lesson for that, which is actually present the credentials of your movie to the audience so that the audience is absolutely hooked in it. This is the best and most wonderful example.
If you'll kind of let me keep upright, sir, perhaps I shouldn't be sick and perhaps I could attend more.
You bring that file and embutters to me in this churchyard tomorrow morning early.
Yes, sir.
And never dare to say a word of having seen such a person as me.
No, sir.
If you do, your heart and liver will be tore out and roasted and ate. There's a young man hid with me, and in comparison with him, I'm an angel.
They do look fantastic, don't they? In their new light. I never knew when I knew you'd chosen that clip. I never knew. I thought, does he identify with Pip or Magwitch?
what do I look most like? Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I always wish I'd met someone like that in my life. Give him a pork pie, and then you get all that money.
Is there a moment when you've been making your films that you've thought, well, what would Lean do? In the way that Tony was talking about how the restorers would think, what would Lean do? Have you used him as a kind of yardstick for a certain film that we can appreciate from your work?
No, I think if you're interested in visual cinema, there are images from lots of directors, and he's one of them, where the kind of images stay in the back of your head. You don't know they're there sometimes. You start to do your own shot, and you start to do it, and you go, oh, my goodness, I remember this. This was, from Brief Encounter or whatever. But, I think, the sheer... Just, I mean, the beauty of that, obviously, I mean, it's just not just... I mean, every time, however many times I've seen it, but, I mean, I still sort of jump when he sees Magwitch, and just the sheer beauty, the elegance of the shots, and this combination of, there's exterior shots there, and then there's a whole lot of stuff there around in the graveyard, which was in the studio, almost certainly, So that kind of could be kind of, clumsy and corny, but it really isn't. It's quite beautiful.
It's one of those adaptations, one of those rare ones that make you want to go back to the book, because it's so faithful to the spirit of the book. It makes you return to the source material. You've done quite a few adaptations in your time. Do you look at him as a man who could... who was great at kind of transposing literature or the written word to the screen?
Well, he was quite funny about that. I mean, in so much as that, he got prickly when people would say, this is the book and you've done your movie, and if people love the book, very often they might not like the movie. And he always used to say, I've only got 2 hours, or in his case, 3 hours, to tell a story. And it's become something else. It's its own world. You have to be faithful and truthful to the original work, but on the spirit of the work, on the other hand, film's an organic process, has to take on a life of its own.
Now, I did ask you if you did have a sort of particular homage at any point to David Lean, but you had more than an homage, you had a rip-off.
I did. No, he was furious with me. I saw him at Pinewood. I did a commercial for Birdseye.
Oh, well, hold on. Actually, let the pictures do the talking.
I'm going to say goodbye.
No, don't say goodbye. Sounds so permanent.
It's only for a very short time.
Roast beef, green potatoes, peas and Yorkshire pudding. Especially handy for people who aren't used to being on their own.
Perhaps we can get some money to restore it.
What? He actually got involved. I mean, he actually was... he took quite great care of anyone nicking his work.
He basically pointed out that I should actually get a proper job and stop ripping him off. Yeah.
was there anything that were you called before the great man? Did you tremble?
No, I did a film called Birdie where I came back from Northern California, and I saw him at Pinewood. So he did. He said so wonderful that you're doing proper films instead of those horrible commercials you used to do, and. He said, where have you been making the film? And I said, I've been in America, sir. And he said, America? And he said America as if it was something on the bottom of his shoe, I always remember that, yes. I don't think he approved of America. He liked more exotic places.
Sir Alan Parker, for your memory and for your wonderful commercial, I look forward to having a roast dinner with you a bit later. Okay. Thank you very much. Great memories from Sir Alan Parker there. We had a host of great actors up on stage to tell us about working with David Lean, the most animated of which was certainly the actress Sarah Miles, who played Rosie in Ryan's Daughter. She told of Lean's ability to find an actor's breaking point.
And my husband, Robert Bolt, he warned me when I was working for David that he likes to find the actor's breaking point, because once he's found it, he then knows their potential and how far he can push them at any given time. So one was always aware of this breaking point. One tried to not let it... Robert Mitchum, for instance, he knew that this is what the game was in town, so he wouldn't allow David anywhere near him. It was like Muhammad wouldn't go to the mountain and the mountain wouldn't go to Muhammad. So they had these two caravans, and I was in the middle, and I had to be a little runner. the go-between between the two, because literally the whole film, they never, ever would go to each other for notes or anything. And then there was another moment, if I may, quickly. You should have gone first, really.
No, it's lovely, fascinating.
There's one more little moment. Leo McCann, great swimmer. David says, get into that sea now. It's a storm sequence now. And Leo says, I will. I'll go into that sea for you, David. I will. But I'm a very strong swimmer. And if my hand goes up like that, that means that you send in the boys quick. Of course, of course, of course. Of course, of course, says David. In you go, in you go, in you go, in you go. So in goes Trevor into this storm sea now. Quite terrifying, actually. And he said, OK, action, and hitting him against the rocks. He's floundering about like this. He's been tossed and turned. And then suddenly Leo's hand goes up like this. No, keep away, says David. Keep away. Go on, keep, wonderful, wonderful stuff, wonderful. No. And then finally the frogmen went in to rescue him. And, you know, Leo came out of that sea. Leo had a glass eye. And he had two left from this great, great glass maker. And he died, this glassmaker, so he really treasured his only last two eyes. And I'll never forget him coming ashore now with a socket full of sand. I'll never forget that as long as I live. In fact, it upset Leo so much that after Rhyme's daughter was finished, he went and took a year off just laying low in Australia. I will just tell one last little story. Because I don't want to end here on a downer. Because I have made David out to be a little bit ruthless here. And he wasn't. There was another wonderful side to his nature, which was that at the very end, they were making a film, my husband and he, in Bora Bora, where they were writing the script of Mutiny on the Bounty. And my husband had a slight tremor. So David said, you can't have a heart attack in Bora Bora. You've got to go back to L.A. and get it seen to. Very wise. So and they're very close, these two now. They've been together for many, many years, and they're like brothers, you know. And so Robert comes back to L.A., where I am at the time. We weren't married at the time. We were divorced. And actually, we're going to get back together that meeting we had then. And he went back into hospital to check up he was all right, and they said he needed a treble bypass. So he has this bypass, and he's fine when he wakes up, but the next day he has a massive stroke, and he's rendered unable to speak or move. And we don't hear from David for 5 years. Not a dicky bird. And then we were living in Hammersmith at the time, and the phone rings. Hello, Sarah. It's David here. David! How wonderful to hear. Tell me, how is the old boy? How is he? I said, well, actually, he's very well. He's doing a film with Putnam. Yes, I gather that. Now, tell me, now, are all guns firing, Sarah? I said, well, I think you ought to speak to him. So I put them on, and my husband's face, I tell you, to hear from David and be back with him. Now, my husband, he spoke like that after his stroke. And there they were, together, making this film called Nostromo. They were doing the script together. And a whole different David came out, you know. He was full of compassion and patience and love for my husband. To see those two working together at the end of their life, you know, just before, of course, David found he had cancer of the throat. Mm. Was the most wonderful time. And I want to thank you, David, for making my husband's last years very happy. Thank you.
The wonderful and slightly weird Sarah Miles there. Prunella Scales took to the stage next to talk about her role as Sarah in Lean's film Hobson's Choice. Prunella recalled how David Lean delved into her character and how this made a lasting impression on the rest of her career.
You all right?
Oh. Well, follow that.
Prunella, that was your first film, was Hobson's Choice?
It was, in fact, just my second film, and I just remember how incredibly kind David was, because I was quite nervous, and it was Hobson's Choice. And I don't know whether it was the test I did to get the part at all, or whether it was a little bit later, it was a costume test, And he came down on the floor, and he just made you feel. He got behind the camera, and I was standing there terribly nervous, and he said, "What's your name?" And I said, "Vicky Hobson." He said, "Where do you live?" I said, "Manchester." And he said, "What do you do?" "I work in the shoe shop." And he said, "Have you got a boyfriend?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "What's his name?" And I said, "Oh God, I forgot the name." "What's it?" And I said, "Albert. Albert Prosser." And he just by asking truthful questions of the character, he just got everything he wanted to know about, you know, what I would do in front of the camera. And I was so touched that he'd taken that trouble. That's all.
Prunella Scales there, talking about Hobson's choice. Next on stage were the actors James Fox and Nigel Havers to reminisce about their time and their performances working with Lean on Passage to India.
How long were you in India, both of you?
Months.
It's about 6 months in all, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was a fantastic time there.
Yeah, we did.
I can remember auditioning. This is how it went. I got a script through the post, and I opened it, and it said Passage to India, adapted by David Lean, and a note saying, "I hope you enjoy this." As if I wasn't going to. Anyway, and then he rang the next day and said, "Would you come and have tea at the Berkeley Hotel where he was staying?" So I went. I was a bit nervous. I went and had tea. And he said, "Did you write the script?" I said, "I loved it. Every line." And he looked at his wife, Sandy, and he said, "What do you think? It'd make a rather good Ronnie, wouldn't he?" She said, "Yes. Would you like to play Ronnie?" "Thank you very much." End of audition. Nowadays, I go to America and it takes me 3 months to get just the smallest walk-on job. What went wrong?
At the time, David Lean hadn't made a film since 1917, since Ryan's Daughter. So it was for 14 years. There was a sort of a big kind of buzz about the fact that he was working again. How did you feel when you got the call that you were going to be back in what was clearly going to be a very prestige project?
Well, I'm like Alan Parkry. I grew up on Great Expectations and Oliver Twist, so they were a sort of boyhood memories. Then, of course, I had Lawrence and Kwai in the 60s, 50s and 60s. So I was very much in awe of him, and I had a rather similar interview for the part of Fielding as Nigel. But it was much harder to get to see him than it was for Nigel.
I don't know why.
Was it? And then he took you out to India. What was working on set with him like, James? What was he like as a director? Was he? You know, there are stories that he was, you know, quite tough on his actors. And Sarah talked about breaking points. Did you get to that with you?
Well, he wasn't just tough on actors. He was tough on the crew. I remember there was a scene in Fielding's house, the famous collar stud scene. And we were all set. It was a fantastic set that John Box had created with David. And we arrived on set to rehearse it early in the morning. And David just threw all John's work out and said, "I don't like this. This isn't Fielding. You know, let's do it again." Of course, he didn't do it in front of us actors, but we knew that the crew were in a state and John was pacing up and down and so forth. And he threw it out until mid-afternoon. So he was tough on everyone. He was tough on himself, I think.
Very tough on himself.
He worked himself. You know, you talked about the extras falling out of the trees, but he worked himself to the bone as well, Nigel.
He was completely obsessed with making the film. And I went out there a month before filming started. I didn't quite understand why, but he wanted me to sort of learn how to drive a horse and cart and stuff like that. And on the very first day of filming, by the end of the first day, he said, "I'm already 5 days ahead of schedule." Because people expected him to be very slow, and I found him to be very quick, actually.
Yeah. He was so scared, wasn't he, of getting behind as well?
Yes, to be 5 days ahead on the first day, I thought was pretty good news. But he said to me,
Peggy Ashcroft arrived, and he said, apparently, she wants to do a read-through.
Yes.
And I said, yeah, I suppose we better. He said, well, what is a read-through? And I said, it's where we go and in a room and we read it through. He said, God, what a frightful waste of time. So we said, no, we think we should do this. And we sat on a Sunday. Mm. I was actually quite hacked off because it was a day off.
Yeah,
but anyway,
yeah, I remember it.
And he sat there and he said, apparently I've got to do this read-through.
Yeah.
So anyway, act one, scene one, let's read it. And then he said, before we start, I'm going to tell you what shots I'm going to have here. And at the end of the day, it was the most wonderful Sunday.
Yeah.
He told us every shot of the film.
Yeah.
Every single shot he had worked out. In fact, at the end of the day, I knew what the film would look like. And it's exactly what the film did look like. And occasionally we got asked to go to rushes, very honoured, remember? And the rushes lasted precisely the time of the scene, because he would shoot from the cutting points. Mm-hmm. He'd only shoot, and when you got up to leave the scene, he'd say, cut!
Yep.
So he never got off my chair, really.
That's right.
He was the sharpest guy I ever met.
James, did you feel that the sort of work that was coming? You said Nigel says that you knew the sort of shots that were going to be made. Did you know the sort of look of the work that was going to how it was going to end up and the feel that it was going to have as you were working on it?
Yes, yes, I think we all did, because as you know, he worked in very close collaboration with John Box and Eddie Fowley. So you know, these sets were absolutely beautiful. All arranged, of course, from the positions that the camera would be in photographing it. So you had a very clear idea of what he was choosing.
It was like he did say to me once that he only ever cast actors and actresses that he could have dinner with. And I thought, that's a weird. But it makes total sense, because you're going to be making a film for a long period of time, and the idea of having dinner with people you don't like is a problem. So he cast us because he liked to have dinner with
us. Yes, indeed. He did.
Good enough by me.
Yeah, this gives us a measure of the man. What was his dinners like? What did he drink? Was he a good drinker?
He drank scotch all the way through dinner, and he had tremendous stories, didn't he?
Fantastic stories.
Of actors and filmmaking and anecdotes. And the idea that he didn't like actors, I don't think is true. He particularly loved William Holden in A Bridge on the River Kwai, coming out of the water, the energy.
He did drink scotch all the time, didn't he? And
yeah.
In India, you had, it was called Paul Scott whiskey, which tasted of curry, basically. Or you had Johnny Walker, which cost £600 a bottle or something. So, but David sort of managed to smuggle in a case of Johnny Walker Black Label, and I noticed on the first dinner, there was a book on the table, Passage to India. I thought, that's very conscientious, bringing the novel to dinner. It turned out to be a hip flask that he'd had specially made, so he'd fill up his own glass with it.
I think that's what's called being faithful to the spirit of the novel.
Oh, very, very funny.
Nigel Havers, James Fox, thank you very much for your memories.
Nigel Havers and James Fox there. Well, that was just some of what went on stage earlier. We also heard over the evening how David Lean's influence stretches onto the young generation of filmmakers. We've got one of the leading lights of that generation, meet Joe Wright. Joe, welcome to the BFI. Why David Lean for you? I mean, where did you first kind of come across his work? Because I remember you telling me that you loved David Lean. I said, oh, you're going to be a great new British filmmaker. Are you going to be influenced by like Martin Scorsese or Jean-Luc Godard? You said, no, Sir David Lean.
I don't know if I said Sir David Lean, did I?
The deferential, you doffed your forelock.
Because everyone loves Martin Scorsese. I mean, I love Martin Scorsese too, and David Lynch is probably another great, great hero of mine. But David Lean teaches you the grammar. He teaches you, he's like classic kind of cinema grammar. And I think you have to learn that before you start kind of playing with it, and so that's important. He's your basics, but then he's so much more than just basic. But you know,
he must have charmed you at a certain age. As a kid, was it the Great Expectations?
Yeah, as a kid, I saw Great Expectations and Oliver Twist and even Brief Encounter, which I don't think I quite understood. But and then Lawrence of Arabia just kind of totally blows you away with its simple beauty.
You can see now, I look at your work in Pride and Prejudice and Atonement, you can definitely see the Lean influence coming in quite a lot, actually.
Can you?
Yeah, in a best way, homage, not rip-off.
Homage. I don't know. I don't think you can help but be influenced by him if you're a filmmaker who loves films. And I am.
But they're both literary adaptations, you know, which he did with Passage to India, and he did it with Great Expectations and Oliver Twist. Both kind of very British as well.
Well, we are both British, and I think I was talking this evening about the idea that David Lean was dyslexic, and I am, and so we kind of I kind of learned my literature from watching his films, or at least a couple of Dickens books. But you know, there's something about the study of it, and that's what I mean also about the grammar, that he taught me a kind of grammar that I didn't learn in the written word.
And you kept that with you as well, all the way through film school, and you've kept those kind of strong visual elements to your work.
Yeah, I mean, it's about how one, you know, as literary grammar is about how one word goes next to another word, this is about how one picture works next to another picture, and how you convey meaning in the relationship in that kind of space between them, and that's the beauty of it for me.
Are you going to be boning up on some of the restored David Leans, this happy breed?
Am I going to be what? Boning up?
Boning up.
What's that mean?
Getting very excited.
That's filthy. I'm boning up.
All over NFT1.
Yeah. I shall be catching them as many as I can. I mean, I can't believe you suggested I'd be getting an hard-on on fucking David Lean. Although I do quite fancy Kay Walsh.
As Nancy.
Yeah.
No, I mean, will you be rediscovering the intricacies and artistry of David Lean through the restoration?
I'll be boning up on Julie Christie and Dr. Zhivago.
Have you seen this happy breed? Have you seen Blythe Spirit?
Yes.
Yeah. Aren't they brilliant?
Yeah, they're wonderful. Oh. They're wonderful. I haven't seen... what haven't I seen? I haven't seen Passionate Friends, and I haven't seen Magdalene, which I hear are his worst films, but I'm looking forward to seeing them.
He was quite into Anne Todd because he was going out with her at the time.
He was very into Anne Todd. And in fact, I just noticed that the poster... of Oliver Twist is a big picture of Kay Walsh, who he was seeing at the time. So he liked his ladies, his leading ladies.
What director doesn't? Joe Wright, thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Well, that's just about all for tonight from the BFI South Bank, where we've been looking at the legacy of David Lean as a launch to a whole season of Lean's films down here. I can't go without leaving the last word to the maestro himself. Here's David Lean from a 1959 interview dug up from the BFI archives.
I've read an awful lot of your notices in the last few days, and technically they have always given them, in every case, 10 out of 10. But one of the more serious magazines did once accuse you of being trivial. Do tell me, what do you think about that?
Well, I'm glad they give me 10 out of 10 as a technician, because I am a technician, and I've come up through the ranks as a technician. And if my content is a bit trivial, perhaps I am trivial and I like trivialities. You see, I'm really Mr. Middlebrow, and I don't understand. I read things like Sight and Sound, you know, and I do get the hang of them, but I can't make the sort of films those gentlemen would make if they could make films.
Well, that's all from this special edition of Film Weekly down at BFI South Bank. You can, of course, find out about the UK tour of David Lean's newly restored film by going to the BFI website, bfi.org.uk. We hope you enjoyed tonight's discussion, and more importantly, you make it your business to get along and see the newly restored films in all their glory. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer down here at BFI South Bank, Jason Phipps, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.